Canadian television nerds. My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Ari Millen. Born in Kingston, Canada, Ari Millen became serious about pursuing acting in his senior year of high school and went on to receive training at Ryerson University. After graduation, he began with small roles on Regenesis, Nikita, Rookie Blue, and Played, and was featured in the 100-person art project that was the subject of Ryan Hughes' short film, Makeout. He also appears in 4 episodes of State of Sin as Hawk. Millen was cast as Prolethean Mark in the second season of the hit series Orphan Black, a role which the series creators expanded to encompass 3 male clones as part of the startling season 2 finale. Ari's recently wrapped shooting as the character of Remy in Hunter's Moon, a film centered on an eccentric billionaire who spirals out of control at the extravagant launch party for his new werewolf mobile game. We'll talk about all of that and some in-the-crease acrobatics during my conversation with Ari Millen. Thanks, Ari, for coming on the podcast this week. We call this the TV ABCs, and I don't know what of the ABCs. Can we just say A stands for actor? Does that work for you, Ari?
Sure, why not?
There you go.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, I would be remiss because everyone who's listening to this podcast is going to want me to talk about right off the bat. And so I'm going to do it. It's going to be unlike the band that plays their big hit at the end of the set.
Right. Yeah.
Let's get
it out of the way.
Let's play the big hit at the beginning of the set so that we can then talk about other stuff as freely as we want to.
Right.
I'm a fan of Orphan Black. I've been watching it since day one. I think it's a fantastic show. So refreshing. And I think a lot of people got a shock at the end of season 2.
Well, me included.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about. So
yeah,
as a character on the show who'd been maybe in, what, 5 or 6 episodes during season 2?
When I signed on, I was told that I was in the first 6 and then I would have a glorious death. So
that sounds almost oxymoronic, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, but you watch the show, I mean, yeah. Like, you know, an Orphan Black death is an Orphan Black death.
Yes.
Like they're pretty great. So I was really, hoping that Helena would take me out in some kind of gruesome way.
And there was plenty of setup room for that, wasn't there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I think what it was going to be, I think Paul was going to take me out.
Okay.
In some kind of great sort of showdown. I got the script for 6 and I read it and I'm like, I'm not dead. And then 7 came and then 8 came and 9 came and I'm not dead. And then I got a phone call and it was, Graham, one of the creators and head writer. And he was like, how would you feel? And this is a spoiler alert for everybody who's now just watching it for the first time on CTV.
Yes.
How would you feel about being a male clone?
So this was after episode 9?
This was, I think it was just before we were going to start shooting 9.
Wow.
Or it was during the shooting of 9. But, you know, the big thing for me was it was like the reveal of the Scarface clone. He was doing pull-ups.
Right.
Shirtless pull-ups. So I had about 2 weeks to buy a chin-up bar and sort of fake that I could do them.
Oh, come on. They were easy. We got to convince people that, right?
Yeah.
I worked really
hard, and I'm going to, and once I get out of my summer laziness, I'm going to, hopefully I'll look even better. But yeah, there was a lot of freaking out and a lot of pull-ups that I was doing.
So it comes, other than maybe the slight clue that you hadn't died yet,
mm-hmm.
which maybe, but did you get any sense at all that it was going to be that big of a thing? Or is it just maybe my character is just going to last a bit longer?
I kept getting the writers would pop in every once in a while and they would sort of drop hints that, you know, that I was like, what's going on? You know, like, why are they saying this kind of stuff to me? And I was kind of getting exciting, but yeah, never did I, never was that my idea. I just thought that, my character Mark was just going to survive the, the season, and that was good enough for me.
Sure,
let me tell you. Yeah,
I'm one of the websites I have open with me now because for those of you who haven't recorded podcasts before, Wikipedia is our greatest friend and wikis and stuff like that. But there's the Orphan Black Wiki, by the way.
Yeah.
And it has your character down there, Mark Rollins. By the way, your family members include unnamed soldier clone and unnamed clone with scar.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. One of those like little Easter egg things about unnamed soldier clone is that if you look close, his name is Miller. Okay. Underneath, and my last name is Millen, so I think that was costume having a little fun.
Oh, there you go.
Well, so, yeah, so someone should update that webpage.
There you go. The wiki needs to be up. Actually, it's a wiki. Probably anybody could update it.
Anyone can do it.
I'm not doing it now. I'm just So that was very cool. I think it caught a lot of us. I mean, I'm a fan of the show. I watch it every single week when it comes out, but. I don't dive into the online. I'm not hearing all the behind the scenes conspiracy theories or anything like that.
Yeah.
So when it came up on me, it really came up as a surprise because I wasn't expecting it at all. I didn't know that there was kind of, I get the feeling that there was people who'd been talking about the fact that there was some mythos that included this other set of clones. I was completely unaware. And so as the casual viewer,
yeah,
it really came as a shock to me. And it opens up the door for so many possibilities in season 3.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to finding out where they're going because, you know, there's some pretty great minds at work there.
So,
and yeah.
No, go ahead. Go ahead and finish.
Well, I don't know if I don't know much how much. I was just going to compliment them, you know, kiss their ass a bit.
No, that's okay. That's never a bad thing.
No.
By the way, one of the things that we always do, now for all you fans of Orphan Black, there we got a bit of the Orphan Black, by the way. One of the things we always do is we enjoy ourselves a beverage update on the TVA podcast.
Yeah.
So the beverage that I'm enjoying this evening, I'm a big fan of bourbon, by the way.
Yeah, nice. I just was at my buddy's bachelor party, and they bought like a really nice 8-year-old. I can't remember what kind it was, but it was delicious.
Yeah, I just went to I did a trip down to Kentucky a few weeks ago.
Oh wow!
And came back with a lot of different bottles. So the one I'm enjoying right now is a small batch. It's called Rowan's Creek, and it's from the Willett Distillery, and it is very, very good. So I'm just if you get a chance to get your hands on it, it's difficult because one of the reasons that I bought the bottle when I was down there is because it's difficult to find in the LCBO up here.
Oh yeah, it's impossible. There's on Dundas Street in Toronto, Dundas, and I want to say Brock.
Yeah.
There is a whiskey bar that has a really great selection of bourbons.
Yeah.
That you know, just like you said, the LCBO has it sort of like. Five, and maybe we'll rotate, you know,
yep.
a guest in there every once in a while. But this one has a whole bunch of ones that, you know, just that they get brought in special. So if you're ever in Toronto, check that place out.
Yes, for sure. So what's the beverage that you're enjoying this evening?
Well, I just finished a movie called Hunter's Moon and watched this sort of connection. So the one of the actors, his cousin, was helping out as in wardrobe, right. And her boyfriend, their family just bought into the Brio company. So we had like a pallet of Brio. So everyone got to take some home. So today I'm drinking a Brio.
If you're Italian, you know what Brio is.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're not Italian, you might not know.
Yeah,
but it's if you ask your Italian friends out there, if you're not Italian, what's the one soda, as they say in the States, or pop in Canada that made its way over to Canadian shores? It's Brio.
Yeah,
and it's one of those pop that you drink it for the first time, you say, oh my god, this tastes horrible, give me another.
Yeah, I remember like I haven't had one in a long time, and I remember liking because you know growing up you see it every once in a while, and it was kind of like. This almost, you know, because it's like it's Coke or Pepsi. Those are like or Cot or whatever, you know. But like the no name brand stuff. But then you every once in a while you see this like crazy red, white, and green pop can. You're like, that seems cool. I'm gonna get one of those. And I don't remember disliking them, but I do. It's kind of like a digestive. Like it's like to what Jaeger is to the Jaeger to the alcohol world. Brio or What's the sort of like the sort of header of like what those types of pops are? It's something starts with a C. I had this whole tutorial from Marco, one of the guys on set who's Italian. He was telling me like it's like that type of pop.
I don't know the word. Maybe we may come up with it before the end.
Okay.
It's one of those vocabulary words that may trip off the end of our tongue at some
point. Exactly. It's Italian for sure.
There you go.
But anyway, so like Jaeger is to alcohol, Brio is to the pop world.
There you go.
Yeah.
So go out and try a Brio. Everyone, go and find a Brio. You'll find it at the back of a fridge in a convenience store somewhere in Little Italy in Toronto.
Exactly. Yeah. It has to be an Italian.
You'll probably find a big display of it.
Yeah. Exactly. Right by the cash.
So doing a bit of my research, I found that you were born and raised in Kingston, Ontario, or
yes.
Raised there anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. First 18 years of my life.
Right. So Kingston, Ontario. Now I've driven through Kingston a few times. I know the Kingston mm-hmm. Frontenac, of course.
Right.
Know that it was the first capital of Canada.
Mm-hmm. Canada. I think Upper Canada.
Upper Canada. Claimed. There you go.
Yeah, we weren't a country yet.
What was it like as a kid growing up in Kingston, Ontario? I'm recording right now from Hamilton, Ontario. I've certainly got my vision of what Hamilton was like. What was Kingston like?
Kingston is a very, I mean, let me take you through the steps of, you know, first, like, growing up there was the greatest place to grow up.
Sure.
It's big enough that there's stuff to do. It's small enough that it's safe. And you're 2.5 hours from Toronto. You're 3 hours from Montreal. You're 1.5 hours from Ottawa. So you're kind of in the middle of it.
Which is why a lot of people have been through Kingston.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you're on the 401, you're going by it.
Yeah.
So I really liked it. And then I moved to Toronto, and Toronto is big city, and Kingston all of a sudden became small town. And when I would go back to Kingston, visit family, it's just itching. It didn't matter if I wasn't doing anything. I just wanted to be in Toronto just because I wanted stuff going on around me.
Sure.
Now, as I'm getting older though,
yeah,
and I go back to visit, it's returning to, you know, it's just a nice place to be.
I always find that people have a romanticism for what they didn't have growing up. Hamilton is not a city like Toronto, but we're 500,000 people. It's a pretty big city. But I have a romanticism for, like, what would have been like to grow up in a small town. And that always kind of, you know, I think that would have been a cool thing to at least part of my life growing up in a small town.
Yeah.
Kingston's kind of like a small city.
Small city. Yeah, I wouldn't call it a town. Like, yeah. it definitely, you know, it has public transit, so. it's reached that benchmark.
And it's got a Tim Hortons.
Oh, it's got, you know, I think it's got one for every 10 people.
Yes. You're much like Hamilton then.
yeah, for sure.
Where I've got the first ever Tim Hortons about 15 minutes from my house, which is...
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Pretty scary. So when did the acting bug bite you when you were there? Was it was as far back as elementary school or high school?
That's a good question. I mean, it was definitely something that was a part of my life throughout the majority of my life. Like, I was always part of school plays in grade school. There was the last 3 years of like grade 4, grade 5, grade 6 of elementary school, there was like school productions. But then every once in a while we would, you know, just the kids of our class would just decide we wanted to do it, and they happily let us, you know, do it at an assembly.
Right.
But me and my buddy Cody, you know, we grew up in the same crib. Like, that were that old of friends.
Right.
His mother was a an art teacher,
okay,
at one of the Kingston high schools. So we had access to one of those old VHS, cameras, recording cameras.
The ones that were like on a stand, or you needed a cart to push around, or?
Or like, you know, you're carrying around it on your shoulder and have to like put it down every 2 minutes because it's so heavy.
Doing tracking shots on an AV cart?
Exactly. But he lived out in the country, so we would just like make all these like weird slasher movies, or just, you know, joke around, or like imitate Monty Python or something like that. But like, we were doing that all growing up.
Right.
And then sports was more or less my life for like the first 18 years of my life. And then grade 12, I did like a one act play night, and it sort of, the bug bit me then. I would say if there was one time the bug bit me, it was then.
That's kind of when you, out of all the performances you'd done up to that point, that's kind of when you got
Like, it just all of a sudden, the like being in front of a live audience and just feeling that energy really sort of spoke to me.
Sure.
And then, but I was still, you know, I was still hell bent on making the NHL.
Okay. So how long did you play? Sorry, I'm backtracking. How long did you play hockey for? Because I played hockey from when I was 4 until I was 16. So I.
Yeah, I think I started when I was 6. I like did power skating from like when I was 4 or 5, and then when I was 6, you know, it was like I didn't play mite, but I played junior novice. Novice, and then 2 years of novice, 2 years of Adam, and onward. And I think I played up until 18. Right. I was 18, and at which point I separated my shoulder.
Okay.
Just at the beginning of the season, and it was going to be a long enough for I was a goalie.
Okay.
So you know I was out long enough that was going to be a hindrance to the team moving forward. So I just sort of didn't do it. And I joined the improv team.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There's quite a transition.
Exactly. Actually,
you know what? From goalie to improv?
Exactly. Yeah.
Pretty close. There's a lot of similarities there.
Yeah.
I mean, flopping around when you're shorthanded.
Quick on your feet. Yeah. So, and then an OAC. I don't think they have that anymore.
Used to be grade 13, which grade even 13. A lot of people wouldn't understand what grade 13 is, but
exactly.
Yeah. Now they're calling the victory lap year, I believe.
Exactly. If you stay a fifth year,
yes.
there are things called focus programs in Kingston, right. And one of them was called Theater Complete. So that's what I was doing for all of, after the bug bit me in grade 12, I decided that I wanted to go do this, this program. And it was just completely like theater based. And we had a traveling show and, you know, all my credits were made up of in some way of some, you know, creative writing or acting, or it was great. It was a great time.
And we're kind of like the little indie films with friends occurring still all through that period as well. Like I'm just curious as to whether it sounds like that's what you started with. Cause I mean, even when I was young, I started with, hey, let's pull out the tape recorder and we're going to record ourselves doing all these different sketches.
Exactly. Yeah. I would say so. I think someone had like at that point it was a digital camcorders were coming in. And I think the summer after OAC, we made like an hour long movie that we took all of August. And that was pretty great.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And so you came out of high school and you said, this is it. This is my life.
Yeah.
Committed to that. This is my passion.
This is my path. Yeah.
Yeah. And so did it start mostly as stage work, or was there an immediate move into film or television work?
Well, I went to Concordia for all of 4 days in the acting program. And I think most university acting programs are theater based. Yeah. Maybe the one in Vancouver, Studio 54. Oh, I'm not sure exactly.
There may be a couple. I did a drama. My second degree is a drama degree from McMaster, and it was all theater based. I mean, there was a couple film courses, but
they
were film study courses.
Yeah, but so where I ended up was Ryerson,
right.
And that was very much a theater conservatory wrapped up in a degree university setting. So you know, we were spending 8 hours a day doing theater stuff and then 3 hour whatever here doing whatever your elective was.
Sure.
So but it was pretty intense. It was very intense, but I got a degree out of it. But yeah, coming out of Ryerson, I was very theater centric. But then once you sign with an agent, you know,
for sure,
that I would say most of them, their goals are film and television, because that's just where the money is and everyone's got to make a living.
Now, a lot of Canadian actors, it seems, and you know a heck of a lot more than I do, but it seems like there's a abundant willingness to say stage, big screen, small screen, I don't care, I want to act.
Yeah, I think that's a common opinion. I know I have that one.
And in Toronto, I mean, that's probably a place where it's not a bad place, because you can actually exercise all three of those if you want to. But because I know that for years and years and years, there was stigmas between the, you know, different fields of acting, like the film actor didn't want to go on television and the television actor wouldn't go on film and the stage, and you'd mix that all up. But I mean, looking back at some of the background page that you have, you've been in stage performances, you've been in films, you've been on television, so I mean, if you're starting off mostly on stage and coming out with mostly a stage background, what were the challenges towards coming out with this study in stage background? I mean, everyone's heard about the difference in terms of scale, you know, in terms of not having a camera being able to zoom up on your face. You have to be bigger on a stage than you do in front of a camera. What were some of the other challenges that you faced trying to go from studying a few years on stage as opposed to saying, now I'm going to be in front of a camera?
Yeah, I mean, basically getting on camera is it's its own crash course because scale, exactly, is, I would say, the first one you have to learn. And it's just bring it down, almost to a mumble in some cases because you've got the mics already on you so they can pick you up. But then, acting for film and television is so much, I would say, a lot more technical.
Okay.
You know, you have to hit your mark. You have to make sure that you're always, and I guess in theater too, you're always trying to find your light. But you know, if it's a close up, then it's even more important for film and television.
But there's a difference between a 30 second take and a 30 minute scene that you're on stage the entire time too.
Exactly. I mean, you can always redo it. So so it's weird. Like they're both stage and film are. They're both great for very different reasons, and they're almost, you know, they're two different skill sets.
Yeah.
Getting
into character for a stage performance, and I've been in a couple, nothing major. But getting you can hype yourself up, you can build yourself up. You're going to live in that world for an hour and a half or 2 hours.
Yeah. And you kind of get sort of your momentum going throughout the show because you start and then it doesn't stop, so you're there.
The world exists around you for that time. That's got to be tough. On television and film, when it's like, you know, I've got a 30-second scene, and then I might not be needed for another 4 hours.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's, you can come away being just exhausted because it's just, there's a lot of concentration involved. And
are there any tools that you use, like on set, when you you're between an hour, 2 hours, and you want to kind of stay focused in character, you know, earbuds, novels. Short stories.
Yeah, privacy. I mean, privacy will work for me if it's something that I feel that I need. But I also really like watching the other performances because that's how I find that I learn the most, especially with film and television, and especially when there's like some real experienced or you know, seasoned vets out there that's, you know, I learn more from them than I do from, you know, any class. It's pretty incredible. So it all depends on the day, but like if it's a super like charged, like, you know, emotionally or what have you, you know, it's just like if privacy is what you need, there's always somewhere where you can go and just sort of be by yourself.
I mean, I'm captivated by creative process in all things, whether it's television, not just film, I mean, musicianship, all that stuff. I mean, I've been playing piano since I was five. I love, one of the reasons that I love doing this podcast where I get to talk to one person for a long time is talk a bit about process. And so you get a script that lands in front of you and you decide, I'm going to do this script and I think I know what this character is going to be. Where do the creative touchstones and the creative marks come for you as an actor versus having to battle what somebody else thinks the character should be? I mean, where do you get to exercise that creativity within? There's got to be so many parameters that are put upon you between what the writer thought the character was going to be, what the director thinks the character should be, what everyone else thinks the character should be, and what you think the character should be.
I mean, it's different for every project. I would say I've been very lucky with Orphan Black that there were very few, if any, sort of notes with that were given to me. And I don't even remember if they. I can't even remember them giving me anything like, "Ari, no, not that." It's just often it's just like, "No, we need you to speed it up, or we need it for time because it's TV, so it has to fit into its 44 minutes, right?"
Right.
But no, I've been very fortunate, and that's kind of what I'm looking forward to with season 3 coming up. Is I got a couple more that I get to sit down and look at. So,
right.
I mean, I got a little glimpse of them in the season finale of the last season. So, I've been kind of formulating in my head. I've had a meeting or two with Graham and John and sort of talked to them. about where they see things going. So it's just, I'm really looking forward to develop these guys.
Sure.
And it's just, so like, to get back to what you're saying, the script, I mean, you got to take everything from the script. You can imagine the hell out of a character all you want, but you got to use the words that are given to you to, right? So it's those are the most important things. So just I get a lot of my clues from the script and you know.
And is it as much as like nailing down like just a, like maybe just in one case, nailing down a specific turn of phrase that you think, ah, oh, that's unique. Why would he be saying that instead of saying that? Like, does it micromanage down to that much on a script, or is it just more of a general tone?
On Orphan Black, I've rarely come across something that I feel that the character wouldn't say.
Right.
I mean, there's definitely wording that is different.
I'm more talking about wording that would inspire you to maybe do something with the character, not necessarily that's wrong with the character.
Oh, no, like, yeah, no, totally. Yeah, I mean, yeah. and that's where I was going. It's like, I wouldn't per se say that turn of phrase or say it like, you know, form a phrase that way. But it does really inform the character when it's written in a certain way. So to the creative process of finding the character and why he says it that way is often really fun. And then you can sort of spitball from there on your own and take it somewhere. But what's great about Orphan Black, the writers is they're taking what the actors are giving to, like, you know, they obviously they've written the scripts. And then, so in the early stages, it's what they've written, but then they're also watching.
Right.
And so they'll start writing for you as opposed to, you're acting their words. You know what I'm saying? Sure. It's a pretty great process.
Well, there's a constant give and take probably from episode to episode. And
exactly.
What you do informs them, what they do informs you. And it kind of goes back and forth. Cause to me, when I saw the character of Mark from day one, a dark character, but there was always a sense of innocence to him as well.
Yeah.
He was dark, but you never felt he was irredeemably dark.
Not how I saw him. Like, that's not how I saw him right off the bat, but I definitely, you know, episode one in the diner, he's pretty sort of one thing. He's pretty dark and that's about it. But then, you know, as I got the next script and I got the next script, he's under the spell of this of Johansson, this very sort of charismatic, leader figure, father figure. I saw him as a father figure, the father he never had, even before I knew the backstory. And so, how do you give status? It's like, you know, someone who is that to you, he can't be that. He can't be that dark person to Johansson. Otherwise, first of all, it'd be really boring. And second of all, it wouldn't ring true, I don't think. So, I mean, again, the writing right there or the situations it was put in sort of informed the character for me, and we kind of went from there.
The nice thing about the turn at the end of the season as well is that I love when I get a situation whereby something that happens later changes everything that I've seen so far.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, looking back on the character of Mark, it changes, knowing what I know now, it changes that entire character.
Yeah.
I'll always say that about, you know, I'll say that often about films that have the rare film that has a better sequel than it had an original film. When it has the better sequel, it makes the original film better. I know that sounds silly. It just does, because now I have a different approach towards it. Now I have a different approach towards that character, and it's made those first few episodes where you, like you say, you thought you were getting killed after episode six, made that character far more interesting. And what's even more interesting to me is you're in your head, whether you're think conscious about it or not, you're thinking, oh, my character's dying in six episodes.
Yeah.
And there's probably a certain immediacy to you playing that character as well, thinking, well, you know, character is going to die. And that's not an intent, certainly, but I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, like you definitely want to make your mark. I was really excited to be on this show that, you know, I like you, I was watching it week to week in the first season because I was just a fan of it and was really excited about it, and then even more excited to get on it. So I just and there were so many like really stand there were a lot of standout characters in the first season, so I was like, I really want to be one of those standout characters. So just, you know, try my best and hopefully do a good job, you know.
I'm waiting for your version of the soccer dad is what I'm waiting for.
yeah.
Maybe the hockey dad. There you go.
Yeah.
Maybe the hockey dad. They could be. So one of the things that I like to ask, because I was informed so much growing up by the media that I consumed, going back a little bit into the youth of Ari Millen, what television did you watch while growing up in Kingston, Ontario?
Oh boy. The Simpsons.
Yeah.
I mean, like after school, I think for the longest time was The Simpsons and then Seinfeld.
Right.
I remember earlier it was like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Blossom. what else did I watch?
So a lot of sitcoms.
A lot of sitcoms. But then and then during high school, I think I was renting up to like 7 movies a week.
Really?
Like I was spending, like I had a job, but I was spending most of my money just renting movies.
Generally, were they similar to just everything, like comedy, drama, science fiction, horror, whatever?
Anything and everything. Yeah. I mean, I would definitely go on kicks of like, I want to, you know, like I would watch a performance and like, I really like this actor. So yeah. Then for the next little while, I would be getting all that. That person's movies, but sure. or a movie would come out finally on video and I would watch that, or and that would get me on a kick of something else. But
by the way, for all the kids listening, there used to be a place called Video Stores.
Yeah.
And we used to go and ask if they had a copy of something, and said they told us all the copies were out.
Exactly. And you would have to wait or put it on reserve. Yeah.
You know, back in the day when we used to get charged for not rewinding tapes.
Exactly. Yeah. Isn't that crazy to think about?
It is. It's absolutely insane. so a lot of movies for you. And yeah, it's amazing. I think that even 20 years before that, people couldn't just go and pick up movies and watch them whenever they wanted to. And it really, the portability of movies and even what's happening today with technology. And I noticed that you've jumped on, you're on Twitter at Ari Millen on Twitter.
Yeah.
And that level of communication, I mean, let's maybe shift a bit into with the way that the show's kind of exploded and the popularity has exploded and now your character has bigger things coming for it. I know that you've been at a couple of the cons that have been out recently.
San Diego.
How has that been? I mean, I've never gone to Comic-Con in San Diego. Now is too big for me. I just wouldn't even want to get near it. Maybe I'm too old, but I just wouldn't want to get near it. But it has to be amazing.
Yeah, it's the most surreal experience that I've ever experienced. Like, first of all, the fans of Orphan Black are just, you know, the best fans in the world. They are diehard. Well, anybody who's going to San Diego Comic-Con is a diehard fan. Let's just put it there. But then, you know, we're driving around from media event to media event, and you just sort of see a Cosima walking on the street, or you see a Helena or an Allison, and then we're just rolling down the windows and yelling at them, and then they see us and they're freaking out, they're taking pictures, and then yeah, like it's on Twitter, it's just like, and then it's immediate, and then they're like just tweeting out like, oh, you know, we just saw the Orphan Black guys, and they, you know, they it's crazy. Like the love is insane. Like I've said it, I can't remember who I said it to, but it's like, if we could somehow figure out how to bottle the feeling and the atmosphere at San Diego Comic-Con, the world, and then sell it or just give it out, you know, the world would be, you know, that's world peace right there. Like it, yeah. It's just an incredible love fest, and it's just, you're allowed to be who you are there. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
So accepting. So great.
Well, it's in many ways become what the internet or the web itself has become. It's like all of the small subgenres that you never thought there was anyone else out there that mm-hmm. cared about the same stuff that you did. All of a sudden, you find there's thousands of people out there that care about exactly the same stuff you did.
Yeah, and then with the world being so much, you know, with social networking and whatnot, you are now able to tap into that and make friends and share common interests the way that you couldn't before. So it's a really interesting time, and it's a really interesting thing to see just people bonding over, you know, like obviously acting is my passion and I'm on a phenomenal show, but like people love it. Yeah. And like there was a couple heart-wrenching I guess they weren't questions, they were more comments, but they were just more like thank yous aimed at the writers and Tatiana's performance, like, and just like specifically about, you know, being afraid to come out to her family, coming out, being rejected, and then as a healing process watching the show and her mother seeing Cosima as a person, not just her sexuality, right. and how that had started the healing process, and that, like, there was not a dry eye in that room. It was incredible. Like 1,000 people that came to that talk. Like it was amazing. Just like that's the power that TV has these days. It's incredible.
And it's the feedback that you never expect that you're going to get. I mean, you think, okay, there's fans of the show. There's, you know, they like the show and all that stuff. But it's the intimate stuff like that, that you'll never see that intimate stuff anywhere other than, like you said, a place where someone feels safe to actually express that.
In a room of 1,000 people. Yeah. Like how often would you bare your soul to 10 people, let alone 1,000? And then it just happens to be about like a fictional show that you're watching that just happens to like parallel your life and is helping it. It's incredible. And it's a wonderful thing. And it just makes what I get to do that much more special. And you know, it just energizes. I think everyone was just like after that, which is like, we need to get back on set. We need to make more. This is just like, this is crack to us. It's incredible.
Are there any shows now that you're a fan of?
Oh man. Like the BBC, let me tell you, the BBC has some of the best television I have ever seen. There's a show called Peaky Blinders, which is just incredible. The Sherlock, the BBC Sherlock is incredible. Luther incredible. Yeah.
I heard that there's rumors now that there will be something new with Luther, whether it's a TV movie or another couple of episodes or something like that.
But no, I really hope
Idris Elba's just amazing in that.
Yeah. And then if you've ever seen The Wire with him, you would never know that he's British. So like they're just finished, caught up on The Killing.
Yeah.
Those first two seasons are just incredible.
I did a Wire marathon, not this past summer, but last summer. I did every season in the span of about a month.
Oh,
and
wow.
Plowed through them. And it's like, it's impactful, but that's the great thing. It's the great thing when at the end of a week, you can sit back and go, holy crap, did that show just change the entire outlook on my week?
Yeah. We had a rule when we were watching it that we were only allowed 2 episodes a day. And when we finished one season, we had to watch a season of something else just so we could space it out. But also because it's so complex that didn't want to miss anything. And I didn't want it to go by in a blur, right? Because it is that good of a show. It's just so, like, from acting to writing to what it's talking about. It's pretty incredible.
So tell me a little bit about Hunter's Moon. So we mentioned it off the top.
Yeah.
Now I'm noticing on the IMDb page, it's got the little TIFF logo up. So I'm assuming that that it's showing at TIFF this year.
No, because we literally wrapped shooting. See, it's been a blur because it was all night shoots. It was 3 weeks of night shoots. So I think we wrapped like on Monday or Tuesday of last week.
Oh, really?
Just as TIFF was starting. So I think I went from.
So it was ready to go to TIFF maybe, but.
Wow. I mean, we had a little party, a media party a couple days ago that we were able to get a lot of people out. So we were kind of like using TIFF as a springboard, but I know they've taken meetings and you know they've got buzz for it already. But what's a great good way to put it? I mean, it's kind of like if Scooby-Doo met
you've got me already.
Yeah, if Scooby-Doo met a horror movie, a werewolf movie, and then you throw in some comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, you can't sort of pin it down as like, it's not a horror movie. It's, you know, it's not, it's more of a mystery, but then all of a sudden maybe a werewolf shows up. So it's like, yeah. So, you know, you can't sort of put it in one box, but, really, really fun experience. And when you see that werewolf, oh my God, it's like just that man who made it, Carlos, is super talented.
Right. Now it looks like I'm looking at the IMDb page, and look, you got to work with Colm Feore.
Yes.
Who is in my mind legendary in Canadian acting.
I've not only seen him
on film and television, but I've seen him at Stratford a couple times as well.
Exactly, and like that, he came on his day off from Stratford. So like, speaking of like switching gears from King Lear to a priest in our movie. Yeah.
I remember I actually first saw him at Stratford back in sometime around like 1989 in Taming of the Shrew.
Okay.
They were doing a 50s interpretation of Taming of the Shrew.
Okay.
And he was playing Petruchio on Taming of the Shrew.
Okay. Wow.
And he's been back there a few times since then. But yeah, just absolutely. I don't think I've ever seen him in something that I didn't enjoy him in.
No, he's...
He's quite a presence.
Exactly. He's one of those guys that will rise in the ranks of, you know, or if not already, of sort of Canadian acting royalty, if not North American or the world.
So how long was the shoot on this film, if you're saying you just wrapped it up?
I think it was just short of 3 weeks.
Okay.
Maybe 2.5. I think I was there 11 days. And it was all night shoots, which I didn't think was possible, but you know, like after the first day, you kind of, your body switches, but it kind of shoots the rest of your life. Like I'm still playing catch up on scheduling and figuring out my life.
So shot in Toronto?
It was shot in Milton.
Okay.
Which is just north.
Yes. North Halton.
Near Guelph. It was off Guelph line. Yeah.
And so what is your character of Remy like in this film?
So Remy is he's a PR person. Hired by Brian, who is this sort of eccentric billionaire who is the creator of this game Werewolves Unleashed, which is this, it was this card game that it's actually a party game. We actually, to change subjects, we played it at the getting to know you party, and it's a really fun game. It's like an adult Duck Duck Goose in a way.
Okay.
Anyways, so it's this Werewolves Unleashed is the name in the movie, and he's now releasing it online. So, you know, social media, whatnot, you can now play this game with everybody around the world. So I'm hired on as the PR guy and more or less, a lot of the time, I'm more or less keeping him in check,
right?
Because he's an eccentric character. And then all of a sudden somebody dies, and then I got to deal with that. And then another person dies, and you got to deal with that. So it's like the things go downhill.
PR nightmares, so to speak.
PR nightmare, because we got the press there, and we got it's just like everyone's trying to survive, and we don't know what's going on. So yeah, it's a really fun time.
So what we'll definitely do is we'll put a link to the IMDb page so people can follow it and see when it's coming. Because of obviously no release date yet, but they're gonna have to follow and see when it's coming out.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. Yeah. It's 2015 for sure is the what they're hoping for.
Yeah. Very cool. So now you're what's the shooting schedule like for Orphan Black? So I mean it's 10 episode seasons.
Mm-hmm.
But how long is your shooting season to do the 10 episodes?
I mean last year was like, I think it was about 8 days, sometimes 9 days an episode.
Okay.
So I think we're like October to February this year. Last year it was like mid September or late September to February. So,
and I love the fact that you're actually shooting in Toronto, a lot of it, and it looks, and it is Toronto.
Yeah. They don't hide. I mean the streetcar, you see the streetcar. Yeah. So, I mean, they don't hide it, but at the same time, I've heard people, and this might be an online sort of, critique that they don't. They're not hiding that it's Toronto, but they're not saying it's Toronto.
That's
and there's a difference, right?
I guess there is, but I mean, in your everyday life, how much do you talk about the fact that you happen to live in a city that you're living in?
Yeah, And like, I don't have a problem.
You don't
with
say,
it.
Isn't it great to be in Toronto right now?
Exactly. Exactly. I know I'm in Toronto. Exactly. I'm in the show. So if anyone's out there listening and they're wondering,
trust me, if you're from nowhere near Toronto,
yeah,
it is Toronto. It's meant, they don't hide anything. There are so many shows that shoot in Toronto that try desperately to not look like they're shooting in Toronto.
Because often it's like a nondescript American city, right? Yeah. Or they'll sort of Photoshop out the CN Tower and Rogers Center just to make it look like, you know, Pittsburgh or Cleveland
Hamilton
or something.
Gets a lot of film shoots like that as well down in our north end, because
a
lot of the houses haven't changed since the 1950s, and we've got the steel mills down there too. So
the industrial, like, so like, yeah,
yeah,
all those movies. Yeah.
So any other projects coming up on the horizon? I know that there's not necessarily anything specific, but more television, more films. Is pretty much television just locked into Orphan Black right now, and the other projects are going to be films for the next?
I'm currently scheduled to be on, do a couple more TV shows before I start.
Okay.
I can't, unfortunately, say which ones, because it's up to them to release but... But we're squeezing these two shows in before Orphan Black goes, and then we're off to the races, which I'm really excited for. But these two other shows are equally exciting.
Do you feel like it's been? I can't stand when people use the phrase meteoric rise, because meteors don't rise, they fall. So let's just say. Do you feel like it's been a fairly quick roller coaster ride up for the past couple of years?
I wouldn't even call it years. I definitely, you know, I've set goals for myself, and every year I've seemed to accomplish them or accomplish, you know, a semblance of it. I signed with my agent who I'm currently with, that was definitely a very nice boost. And then, but you know, if there is a meteoric rise that's taken place, it's as soon as I got on Orphan Black that really, not only getting on the show and then getting six episodes initially, that on your resume opens doors. But then as soon as the big revelation at the end of the season happened, it definitely, you know, it's pretty crazy.
It's amazing how many tumblers have to fall into place. Getting on the show, getting on the air, getting past the first season, getting past the second season, and then all of that to the side that it actually catches. Because how many shows are on for a season or two and they just don't catch like this one has caught on?
Exactly. And then people actually like who you are, right? Because that's not a guarantee either. So, you know, I've been counting my blessings and, you know, I keep pinching myself, and it's not real yet until we get back, but it's pretty nice. I'm not going to lie. It's nice to know that I'm going to do what I want to do for a living for the next year. Like, I know, like, my year is made, which for is, sure. You know, I don't have to serve. I don't have to serve this year, and that you have no idea how great that feels.
Yeah,
it's. I'm very happy. I'm very happy. Yeah,
that's awesome. Last question I want to ask you. If you could see I apologize. I'm going cheesy back to an Orphan Black question here, but it's kind of looking into the future.
Okay.
With the clones that you could be having next year.
Right.
What's the dream clone that you'd like to play?
Well, I have I know a little bit about what I'm going to be playing, and I'm really, really, really excited about what I'm going to get to do. So, I think it's already happened, and
I'm still looking forward to NHL goaltender clone.
But we'll have to edit this part out, because that, you know, you just spoil it for everybody, but. No, like what they've got coming is, I'm really excited about.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on this week.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that was great.
Well, thank you very much for listening to the TV ABCs podcast. where every second week we're going to bring you somebody from in front of or behind the camera, someone involved with Canadian television, and have a long-form discussion with them. And if I could bend your ear for a quick second about our new Patreon. Patreon is a service that helps with sustainability of a product, whether it's a podcast, a blog, a website, so that when we put out content, you kind of use a micropayment approach to kind of help us out a bit, whether it's through the server space it takes up to serve the podcast or just to help us make the podcast better. If you go to patreon.com/TV_EH, you can give as little as a dollar per podcast. That's 4 podcasts a month. That's $4 a month. We would certainly appreciate it, and it will help us do this job even better and bring you even more content on Canadian television. Hey, if you're listening now, you got to enjoy it, right? Okay, maybe I'm just fooling myself. You got to enjoy it on some level, don't you? Oh my God, I'm ripping out my heart here, everybody. Please. You can find all of my other podcasts at anthonymarco.com. You can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. Thanks very, very much for listening. That wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.